Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Katie Galley, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Katie, this is going to be a fun one.
Yeah, it is.
Two of your favorite topics.
Yes.
Marketing and money.
Yes, there we go.
The things that make the world go round.
Obviously, yes.
All right, we're going to kick off today's show with Arnold Huffman with Digital Yala. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
All right. Tell us about Digital Yala. How are you serving folks?
Yeah, we're a marketing agency here in town. Great to be back on. We were here last year after we were announced to be the tag agency of the year in town. So appreciate the chance to come back in and talk about all the good things.
See, we didn't scare you away.
No, right? No. But yeah, just so for those who don't know us in our background, we're a marketing agency that kind of encourages our clients to try something different by kind of getting out of the box and breaking the rinse and repeat mold, if you will, and take a little bit of an atypical approach to their marketing. And by doing so, produce something different or better than that what they've been doing. So our approach to that is using film art, music, and sports to create that new inspiration for what they're going to put out there.
Now, the way you leverage those different, what do you call them, entertainment channels?
Yeah, film art, music, sports, yep.
Is it you immerse the brand in that, or you use those as elements in the marketing?
We use it as a way to come up with the idea. So, for example, when we go through the creative conversation about whatever it is we're going to create with a client,
right?
We ask a series of questions, we get a series of answers, but ultimately we need to boil that down or distill that down into a central concept. And the last question we will typically ask a client is, if this were a song, what song would this be? And that helps us get that to that central idea or concept.
So now, what are some songs that clients have said?
Yeah, so some of the recent ones, we have a tech company up in Ohio picked Imagine Dragons, the song Thunder, because they wanted to really make a striking impact, if you will. Local client here, Hancock Claims, picked Survivor, Eye of the Tiger, because they help clients during the storms when they roll through, so they're always on the move.
So what song does Digital Yala pick?
We roll with either the Foo Fighters or Prince, so it depends kind of in our mode or mood of the day.
Not Kiss?
I'm wearing Kiss today because as a credit to a new client of ours who has the exclusive rights to distributing the Kiss wine in the United States.
Ah, so there you go.
Last week we were writing copy for the website using Kiss lyrics, which was really fun.
Kiss was my first concert.
They were up there. I don't know if they were first.
When I was in Miami, Florida, that's where I'm from. The first time I've ever been to a rock concert was Kiss. And it was general admission back in the day. There were seats. And I got a guitar pick from Gene Simmons.
Oh, that's fantastic. Hopefully
and I'm
you still
like,
have
this
it.
Is like an amazing, is every concert like this is fantastic.
You still have that pick?
No, it was in my car and then my car was robbed and then they took the pick.
Oh man, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah, this shirt actually is from the 96, 97 reunion tour. So it's a true vintage.
So now, why the importance of music as part of your process?
It's just a way, like I said, to get folks thinking about their challenge differently. It's definitely a different question. Everybody that we work with, the first thing they say is, I've never been asked that. But ultimately, it gives them a way to look at this through a different lens, give them a way to try to come to a different answer, again, so for us to produce an atypical output that they haven't done before.
Now, your agency seems very creative. Do you also dive into the analytics and the data side of marketing?
We do, because a lot of our work is predicated on learning from what is working and what isn't working. The best way, especially in digital, to do that is through analytics. That analytics, though, the challenge that we see a lot of clients having is being able to correlate that together.
Well, there's a lot of data and some of it matters, some of it doesn't, right?
Yeah. The challenge our clients never have is I don't have the data. That's never the problem.
That
the
used problem to be a is, problem. Now yeah, it's not a problem.
The real problem today is what do I do with all this data and how do I make heads or tails with these various parts?
So, and just because I can measure something, is it worth measuring?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So the key is in the correlation of what triggers what and how you learn from that, and then taking that learning into the next thing you would do as far as a campaign or with your website.
So what's an example of leveraging data that you've done with a client?
Yeah. So looking for really peaks and valleys is the key. Those peaks and valleys will tell you if you're winning or losing the game is kind of the core or the analogy that we use. If you're winning the game, you're having good days, means lots of people are paying attention and the data is looking good. So what do we take out of that as what's creating that upswing of people paying attention? Is it the type of content? Is it the frequency of the content? Is it the form of the content, i.e. video versus a very good graphic or the language involved in that graphic? So that's what we're looking for as far as the insights, taking those and then applying those to the next week or 2 or 3 weeks in terms of output that we want to generate for the client.
Now, do you drill it all the way down to like money has been gained or lost, we're selling more, we're selling less?
We can go that far. We have a pyramid that kind of shows how the lower levers impact the higher levers, which money being on the higher level. We have this kind of stair step picture that we work through with clients of when we tweak these parameters on the low end of the marketing engine, they generate this on the high end of the marketing engine.
So like, is there a correlation between Instagram and selling?
There's not a direct one. That's the key in today's world is that there's so many moving parts, right? There's Instagram, there's Facebook, there's email, there's billboards, there's TV, there's radio. The key is to figure out where are you winning the game. Ultimately, I tell a lot of clients, look, just because you ran social media doesn't mean they're going to buy from you that day through social media. Really, right. What they're going to do is end up on your website, further research you, and then decide what they're going to do with you as a vendor or a partner.
But because it is such a there's a lot high level of complexity, and there's a lot of data points pushing people and educating people, and there's a certain level of ubiquity that every business has, right, in a variety of channels. Can you even discern like, okay, this is working well or this isn't working well? Can you correlate that?
It's not a one-to-one, but it's the mix of how those things work together that lead to, the number one metric we look at is traffic and length of time on the website. Based on that, then we try to correlate which channels or what things that we're doing in social media.
So you're kind of working backwards.
Yep. So we start from the top and drill down and figure out what's causing us to win today.
So like if somebody bought something, you can go, okay, the thing they did before they bought something was this. And then you just keep working backwards until you get to that Instagram.
And that'll be one of the things. You won't necessarily know exactly that's the thing, but there'll be certain things that you did that day that lead to that. And those are the things we want to repeat.
Right. Now, so are you always running experiments? Because it sounds like everything would be an experiment. It's a living, breathing thing.
So using the word experiment, we use the word hypothesis. So when we look through that data, we pull out hypotheses. Those are the insights that we want to use as repetitive actions going forward.
And then so once you have a hypothesis that we think that this channel or these three channels are going to be the most beneficial, you're trying different things and then you're tweaking those and you say, you know what, we thought LinkedIn would be better, but it's not. So let's kind of scale back down there and then put more emphasis in Twitter or something.
That's
like
exactly
that.
Right. Yep.
So that's constantly happening.
It's constantly happening. We do that weekly, pull all this data together, look at it in that macro level and drill down. And then, like I said, pull out the hypotheses and create the next game plan for the next couple of weeks.
Now, what's a reasonable amount of time to get enough data to make an informed decision?
Well, most folks already have data. That's not a problem. So once we get in there, we'll get our hands on the last 3 to 6 months, do the baseline with that, and then start creating the plans going forward.
Now, what about all the new technologies like virtual reality, augmented reality? Like, how does that fit into a mix? Because some of that is so brand new and cutting edge that there's not a lot of people using it, and there are enough people that are, you know, could move the needle in a measurable way, but some people, as part of their brand, they want to be the ones playing on the edges like that.
Yeah. So a lot of our clients, again, back to getting out of the rinse and repeat mode, let's not confine ourselves to thinking that a certain technology or capability is for them or not for them. Let's use all the
things.
Or at least come up with an idea of how this might work for you.
Right.
Right. And so let's not limit ourselves. So, but yeah, there's technology, there's certain ways of presenting the brand or the message that, again, folks have kind of tried in the past, maybe gotten stuck in a rut. And our job is really to encourage them and push them and challenge them into a different mode.
So then that's part of your process. You're always including kind of the newest technology?
Technology, or even opportunistically. So if it's an experience, what else can we add to this experience that's going to make this different for that brand or for that customer that's looking at the brand?
So what's an experience example?
So an experience would be a customer event, and we're going to host a customer event. And let's think of everything from the very top of what the brand and the message of the event's going to be, all the way down to if we ran an event at Stats down on Marietta one time, and the ticker tape that's in there to sports bar typically is showing you the sports scores.
In this case,
we changed that. We had the opportunity to rewrite what was on there, and we put movie quotes on there while people were ordering their drinks. They got to look at funny movie quotes to keep them engaged.
Right. So because you were able to put the event there and you were leveraging all of what that
everything
space
that
had.
They offered.
Yep. Right.
Yep.
And then, so for your clients, so you're doing events, you're doing digital marketing. So it's more than digital marketing then if you're doing events.
It is. In our branding, you'll see if you get our website, while the URL is Digital Yalo, and that's where we started. Really, about 2.5 years ago, we started being asked to do a lot more than just digital for our clients. So it's branched into mailers, prints, events.
So full service?
Pretty much full service at this point. That's correct.
And now your clients are coming from all over the place?
We are. We do about 80% of our work is east of the Mississippi for an easy categorization. But as far as B2B versus B2C, it's about a 60-40 split, a little heavier on the B2B side. And size of clients is a wide range as well. We've worked with $2 million startups up to $20 billion global manufacturers. So
and they're not just in technology. They can be in any industry?
Just about any industry. Education, government, manufacturing, distribution, high tech, retail.
Now, how has it been for you since being kind of recognized by TAG? Was that helped? Did that springboard you to a new level? What was the outcome of that a year later?
Yeah, I think it definitely did help us. I think we did a pretty good job of promoting that. And as I call it, we're still carrying the Stanley Cup trophy around for another 2 months. In November, the new folks will get anointed. But every client we go and speak with, we talk about the award. It's up on our website. So yeah, we've promoted it pretty heavily, and I think it has helped us.
Now, for you as leading the agency, are you at a point now where you can spend some of your time giving back and serving the community as well as just keeping the foot on the pedal to grow?
Yeah. So that has been one of my interests and passions for a long time. And so now having that opportunity, it's also a way to meet more folks around town. Right. And so, I'm a member on my university board, which is Case Western up in Cleveland. So actually heading up there 2 weeks for the next board meeting, and then joined the board here for the Military Family Support Center, which is can't really use the word commissary, but it's a sale that comes up because there is no commissary on the base at Dobbins. Mm-hmm. And so this was created by the Cobb Chamber in conjunction with other military efforts to put a store or a sale in place for the it's almost 400,000 veterans in active duty military in North Georgia.
Now, for you personally, is the agency growing as you imagined it would?
Yeah, I think we've had, first and foremost, we try to enjoy what we're doing, and hopefully our clients are enjoying what we're doing. So we've had quite a shift in our business over the last 2 years where we're pretty highly diversified in terms of industry and number of clients. You know, as of halfway through this year, we had already passed last year's numbers. So things are growing, quite positively, and we'll see where that takes us. But our idea would be that we're going to be a position of strength, hopefully. Nobody wants to talk about the market downturn, and maybe Julie will be speaking about that coming up. But, it's inevitable. And so we're really striving to be in a position that we could be successful even through that.
Now, what about the culture of the agency? How did you kind of create a culture that you were proud of?
Yeah, so it's really a one of flexibility. I have a statement where anybody that we hire, I tell them, look, I just want the work done. It's going to be good, whether you do it from the beach bar or your bed, right? So we're not the kind of folks who show up at the office at 8 and leave at 5. A lot of my team members will be up early working at 6, take a break, walk their dog or whatever. And conversely, is folks who are not the early risers, get up later, but work, you know, I can guarantee I'll get an email from them at midnight. So we have a highly flexible and committed team. And because of that, you know, we don't go sit in an office. We don't waste time commuting. We're staying productive during those downtimes.
So it's virtual?
Mostly virtual. We have office space because we have clients who come in. We have meetings and such. Right. But when we're cranking away on work, everybody's doing it in their own confine and comfort and being able to stay highly productive.
So how do you kind of leverage the benefit of having a team working on something? Like the, you know, just the collaboration of everybody in a room together.
Yeah. So
that all happens using technology.
We use technology. We use instant messaging and we're on the phone a lot amongst the group. We do lots of group calls. But again, we don't waste time people walking in the hallway and chit chatting. We don't waste time people driving to work. Most of that is all productive work time.
And then the same with the client contact. That's all virtual or primarily virtual?
Yeah, because only about half of our business is actually here in Georgia. Mm-hmm. The other half is those other geographies that I mentioned. So even in those cases, whether they're here, they're not necessarily just down the road. They could be up in North Georgia or another state. So all of that or most of that work is done virtually. And it's through, again, a high level of communication.
Now, you mentioned that you're from Cleveland or went to school in Cleveland.
Yeah, both.
Any desire to go back?
Well, part of our team, we have a second office in Cleveland, so part of the team is there. I get the opportunity to go home, if you will, probably every 6 to 8 weeks. So that probably scratches that itch in terms of moving north, because my wife has clearly told me that's not happening.
That's not too cold. All right. So if somebody wanted to learn more and have a more substantive conversation about digital yellow, what's the pain they're having where you're the right solution?
Yeah, if you go to our website, which is digitalyalo.com, what you'll see is Defy Fly on our banner, and that's really our tagline for this year. And again, what that means is be willing to try something different, take an atypical approach to produce a different outcome. And so if that's the challenge that they have, that we're really the vendor for them, we've got other clients who or prospects who talk to us say, hey, send me a case study in my industry. And my answer to them is, I'm not going to do that because that's not why people hire us. They don't hire us because we're this greatest in health food or education or whatever industry they're in. It's our work will stand out because we're going to have them do something different and produce something different.
Mm-hmm. And it'll be custom to their challenge.
It's going to be very specific. And as again, I like using the word atypical than what they may have thought what they were going to go do or come out at.
Good stuff. Arnold Huffman, thank you so much for sharing your story today. Once again, the website for Digital Yalo is Digital Yalo, and Yalo is spelled Y-A-L-O. .com.
Yep. Thanks.
Good stuff. All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we got Julianne Andrews, the principal with Atlanta Financial Associates. Welcome, Julianne.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Julianne, the first thing that everybody wants to know is, what's it like to have the name of someone famous? Is that a blessing or a curse?
It is actually a good thing. You will never forget my name, Julie Andrews. It's on my business card, you'll see Julianne, so we can dispense with those jokes early on.
Right.
But no one will ever forget my name.
So you have to deal with this every time?
Every 100%. Time. Every time. I always tell people only for the last 35 years since I got married. That, other than that, it was something
that's
different.
That's what was the thing.
Exactly.
So did you consider that when you were getting married? Were you weighing that in your head?
I did weigh that in my head. Great guy, though, so I moved forward.
So you went forward. So tell us about Atlanta Financial Associates. How are you serving folks?
So this is a really exciting time for our firm, and I'm glad to be here today to talk about it. You know, there's a lot of choices in Atlanta and all over the country, really, for investment advisory firms. We just this summer celebrated our 26th anniversary as a firm, and we're very proud of that. Also proud that despite all the noise and all the other options out there, we've been recognized nationally on the Forbes Honor List of Best Financial Advisors. And actually in January, our firm will be in the Wall Street Journal as one of the wealth management firms you should know. So it's an exciting time for us, and I'm happy to be able to talk about it.
So now, is there a difference between like an investment firm, a wealth management firm? Are these all synonyms or are there different services associated with them?
There's a lot of confusion out there. So we would call ourselves a wealth management firm. And what that is really, and by our definition, is a very comprehensive relationship with clients. So we can do a financial plan for a client to help them meet all their financial objectives, but not just that, really talk to them about what their desires, goals, and dreams are. What do you really want to do? What's all this money for? What's the purpose of this? And how do you want to manage that? We do obviously manage investment portfolios for clients. So our tagline is making life's journey richer. And the idea behind that is clearly it has a double meaning. We are growing portfolios for clients, but we also want to make sure that your life is rich, you accomplish all your goals, and we understand all of that.
Now, is that a disconnect in the mind of some maybe people new to this, that they think like your job is really to just make more money for me, and they're not looking at their life holistically as what do I want to accomplish? What kind of legacy do I want to lead? Things like that.
That is a challenge. There are firms out there that simply manage portfolios for clients. That's not us. So when a client comes to us, a new client, we spend a lot of time talking to them about their goals, their objectives, their dreams, the kind of legacy they want to leave for their family. We work with a lot of multi-generational families. I have many instances where I'm working with three generations. And so we spend a lot of time making sure there's a good fit between what we do and what we really bring to the table and what the client's looking for. If they're looking for just simply portfolio returns, we're not going to be the place to go for that because we're trying to do something much bigger than that. You're going to get portfolio returns, but we're going to help you do a lot of other things too.
Now, I read recently, and it seems like you're addressing this by dealing with the different members of the family, that the vast majority of when a person dies, their kid doesn't go with that same financial advisor. It was like 60 years. I was shocked at the number. And that to me was such a missed opportunity for the industry because it was like, you've been dealing with this family for decades and you're not engaging the children. I mean, that seems like a missed opportunity.
It's a huge, huge miss. And I think a lot of firms fall into that trap.
So that's a true statistic?
That is a true statistic that about 60% of second generation folks do not stay with the same firm. Part of that is because they don't really understand what the value that's brought to the table. Part of it is if you are simply managing a portfolio for a client, they see you as managing a portfolio. Well, I've got my guy. Maybe I live in Cleveland. I'm not in Atlanta. So what do I care? I've got somebody here that can do that. But if you include the members of the family and all the different generations and they understand what you're doing for them, they look upon you very differently. We also take a team approach. So if someone's working with our firm, they're not just going to work with Julie Andrews. They're going to work with me and my team. There are a number of people that they can contact. And so what happens is, and some of the folks on my team are younger than I am, and so they will develop a particular rapport with someone, but they feel that they have a real relationship and a real kind of a bond to the firm that you wouldn't have if we weren't reaching out that way. So in our case, it's unusual actually when a client passes away that their second or third generation don't stay with our firm.
So now walk me through like a new client. How does that even occur? Because I would imagine most of your clients already have a financial advisor or somebody that's advising them in some manner. They're not kind of doing it themselves, right?
Yeah, well, the vast majority of our clients actually are referrals from existing clients. And that's nothing could make me happier than that because that's a real testament to how they feel about what we do for them. We do also get referrals from CPAs and attorneys that we work with. But when a client comes to us, generally speaking, you're correct. They do already have a financial advisor. Most folks will have a financial advisor or they'll have somebody that they feel like is a financial advisor.
Right.
But there's some reason. And the first question we always ask them is, why did you call our firm? You know, and to really ascertain, because there's usually some underlying concern or question, something that they feel like is not being addressed in their current situation. And usually it's not feeling like they're getting that holistic approach, not feeling like somebody's pulling everything together for them and helping them make sure that there aren't any traps out there that they haven't identified.
Now, is the financial advisor kind of the quarterback of a family's kind of financial side of their life? You know, are they helping with the insurance and the taxes? Are they kind of having their fingers in all those pies, or are they just a part of the team?
I will call myself a quarterback very frequently. I'll say, we're going to be your financial quarterback. And what that means is I'm going to make sure that all the pieces of the pie fit together. So we're going to look at your entire situation. If it looks like you need your will redone, for instance, we'll work with your existing attorney to make sure that that happens appropriately, or we can refer you to somebody else if you'd like to do that. We'll look at your insurance portfolio. We will work with the insurance person that you're working with and make sure that whatever we feel is missing is put in place. But we want to be kind of the go-to quarterback. So I have clients that call me about all kinds of things. I have clients that call me about little things like, should I buy or lease a car? And then clients will call me about big things. Gosh, I'm thinking about selling my house and, you know, going to Europe for a couple of years. I actually have a client that's doing that right now. How would that look? That's different than what we've talked about before. But I want people to call me about all those things, big and small.
And then, and so is there a typical rhythm of how often you speak, or that varies client to client?
Usually varies client to client. When we typically take on a new client, there'll be a lot of meetings in that first year because there's a lot happening. We're getting to know you. We're making sure that everything is set up the way you want it to be set up. We're getting to know your other advisors, if you will. So all that's happening. After that, typically we'll meet with clients a couple of times a year, but we're interacting with them much more frequently than that because, again, they're calling us and asking us questions. But we'll typically do a couple of formal meetings a year just to review their situation and really... Well, yes, we spend some time talking about their portfolio and the financial markets. That's obviously, they expect me to do that. But we spend more time talking about, are they still on plan? Are they still where we thought they should be to meet the goals we discussed and they want to accomplish?
And then so that on plan, that could be quarterly, 6 months?
Could be quarterly. Some clients we meet with as frequently as quarterly. Some clients like to do that. A lot of times we'll meet with clients more frequently initially for the first several years. And then they, okay, I get it. On track. Right. I feel comfortable. And they'll go down to maybe a couple times a year.
Now, are you seeing a trend to go with kind of the boutique services like yours as opposed to kind of the TV commercial ones?
There is a trend in that direction. You're seeing a big move in the industry to go independent. So you're seeing a lot of firms in the industry move from the big wirehouses like a UBS or a Wells Fargo or the banks, those kinds of things. You'll see them move away from that and become completely independent. When they do that, a lot of times that allows them to really craft their business the way they think it needs to be to serve the client base that they have. So they're not being driven by products or services that UBS or Morgan Stanley wants to offer.
When you say they, who's the they?
So the investment advisory firm. So if an investment advisor decides, I'm going to go independent, I want to leave the confines of being with a wirehouse or a bank, and I want to be completely independent, that allows them to structure their business in a completely agnostic fashion with respect to technology, pricing, all of that. And that's actually something that our firm did this summer that's very exciting. So we left an independent broker-dealer, became an independent registered investment advisor, which allows us to really tailor all the products and services to what we feel our clients need to meet their goals.
So what's the pros and cons of making a move like that? So what you're giving something up by doing that, right?
Well, when you're with a larger firm, they're providing everything to you. So they're providing a suite of technology to you. You have the pricing is set. Typically with an independent firm, an independent broker dealer, you can offer whatever products you want, but the offerings might be limited by selling agreements that the broker dealer has. In the independent registered investment advisory space, there is none of that.
Right. You have a blank sheet of paper,
You have
right?
a blank sheet of paper. I can use whatever technology solutions I want. We can select the firm that where we want to hold our assets. It might be Schwab. In our case, it is Schwab, but it could be Schwab. It could be Fidelity. It could be TD. It could be a combination of those. You are really operating your own business. You're making all those decisions from pricing to technology to deliver the best service possible to your clients.
And that way you can customize the solution no matter, you're not tied to one anymore.
No, you're not tied to one thing, and you can look at each client situation individually and determine what will actually meet this client's needs and then craft a solution for that particular client.
So now, and you said this is a trend in the industry, more and more are doing that?
More and more are doing that. And it's really simply because there is, you know, Wells Fargo is a perfect example. You know, I might be a great advisor, but if I'm at Wells Fargo, I've got a problem now. And right. so that then, and I didn't have any control over that. So advisors.
But you're taking the hit for their.
You're taking the hit for behavior, their behavior, for the decisions that they made at the corporate level. So if you're completely independent, you don't have any of that. I mean, you have only yourself to answer to and your clients, because that's really the bottom line.
Now, in this world, I hear the word fiduciary thrown around. Can you explain what that is and why that's important?
Yeah, there is some confusion there. So that really the literal definition of fiduciary is acting in the client's best interest. And I think the general public would expect an investment advisor to always act in their best interest, right. along with their physician and their attorney and their right. CPA and any other professional they see. There has been, though, some resistance in the industry to hold yourself out as a fiduciary, because the feeling was, well, gosh, if I do that, then I have additional liability. Our firm has always been on the other side of that. We've always held ourselves out as fiduciaries. We make that very clear. If you look at our website, that's very clear. I actually have, and all the advisors at our firm have designations that speak to fiduciary. So I'm an AIF, which is accredited investment fiduciary. And it's important for us to hold ourselves out that way, because we want to make sure that we're very clear that everything we're doing, everything we're recommending, is going to be in your best interest.
But it fiduciary doesn't mean that the stock market's going up and all your money's going to get, you're going to make more of it. It's just, you're going to be a responsible steward.
I'm going to be a responsible steward of your money. And when I make a recommendation to you, whether it be a recommendation in terms of needing to get your legal documents drafted or a different investment strategy, I'm doing that because I feel it's in your best interest. You know, we can never, there's no guarantees in my industry.
Right.
We can't guarantee right. anything. But what we're trying to do is to help you meet your financial goals, understanding that there's going to be ups and downs in the markets right. in between.
And that's part of the relationship, is to understand the client's risk tolerance and to put them in things that they're comfortable with.
We spend a lot of time on that. For better or worse, I went all the way through 2008, 2009. I went through the tech bubble at the end of the... And I've been doing this for 30 years, so,
right, so
I've been through a lot of these.
Ups and downs.
A lot of these. And the key with meeting financial goals, because I know I've had conversations with clients 20 or 25 years ago about what they wanted to accomplish, and now here we are 25 years later, and they're doing exactly what we planned. So that's the really cool part about what I do. But I know for a fact that to get you there, I have to find a portfolio that has a level of risk in it that will allow you to ride out those ups and downs, because I know that they're coming. I don't know when they're coming.
Right.
I know they are coming.
They don't ring a bell.
No. If I knew when they were coming, that would be fantastic for everybody. I just know that it will happen. And so when something like a 2008 happened, we literally called all of our clients, and then we called all of them again, and then we called all of them again. And
right.
the objective was not to tell them when the market was going to turn back up or to make some kind of an investment recommendation. The objective was just to make sure that they were comfortable, that they felt comfortable writing this out, that we were on top of it, and that making a change in the midst of something like that is the worst thing you can do.
Right.
So that, and so we're very proud of the fact that very, very few of our clients actually jumped out of their portfolios over that period of time. I work with about 170 families, and I think I had three or four that just said, I hear what you're saying. I can't take it.
The sky is falling.
But it was mostly just around getting you calmed down and refocused back on, why are we doing this? Why,
right.
you know, what are your objectives? What are your goals? And it's not what's happening today. It's what you want to happen 5 or 10 years from now.
Now, having done this for a while, what have you learned from a human behavior standpoint when it comes to risk? Like, are certain groups take more risk, or do you have any generalizations that you can you tell if a person, like, they're going to be, they want a lot of risk, or this person, they don't want any risk?
There's a litany of things that we do, some questions we ask, some that we take people through to try to help them, yes, and try to help them figure out exactly where are you on the risk spectrum.
Right.
We look at their existing portfolio to see where that slots with respect.
So it's one
to
thing to say it, another to demonstrate
to
it when
it,
you're
right.
actually writing a check.
You're
right?
telling me you're really aggressive, but your portfolio is all in CDs. So how
right.
does that? So you're not. That doesn't match
right.
up. So we'll spend a lot of time doing that, and the idea behind all that is just to make sure that that we've talked about it. We actually have clients sign an investment policy statement, which just says, this is the risk level I think I'm comfortable with. Obviously, it's not cast in concrete. It's your money. We can change it. But it is something we can go back to and say, okay, what's changed since we signed this? Let's talk about that.
Right. So it's like if someone says, I don't want to take any risk, but can you put me in some Bitcoin, you know, that's not congruent, right?
That's not congruent. And that's where, you know, having those good conversations up front is productive, because if clients come into our office and they're just kind of kicking the tires and they say things like that, then, you know, we'll tell them, look, this is not going to be a great fit for you. This is not what this firm does. We're here to help you accomplish your goals and dreams. We're not here to necessarily get you the best.
My kid showed me this blog.
Yeah. Or I have a client whose son was saying, Mom, you need to invest in some marijuana stocks. I'm like, okay, that's great for your 30-year-old son. Not so great for Mom. Yeah.
Right.
So we have, you know, we always go back to, what are we trying to accomplish here?
Now, what about from a technology standpoint? Do you does your firm lean on technology? So for your clients to access their accounts and can they make changes with the technology?
We do. So we have a very robust client portal that clients can go into. They can look at their portfolios there. They can actually aggregate other accounts there. They can make their 401k feed through there if they want to, their bank account, so they can actually see everything in one place. They can look at their financial plan out there.
So it's a dashboard where they can kind of get an idea of how they're doing.
They can see how they're doing. They can see if they're still on plan. With respect to trading their own accounts, that's a really good question, because actually prior to this summer, with us making this move, they could not do that. Now we can. We have our accounts at Schwab. So if someone, and I have a few clients who like to have a brokerage account and play around with some stocks rather than calling us and having us place the trades, I can turn on Trading Authority and you can do it yourself if you'd like to, or we can do it for you. It's just up to you.
Now, part of your firm's uniqueness is that you serve, I don't know if it's primarily, but you have a heavy dose of physicians. Is that?
I do in my own.
That's your own personal?
In my own personal.
But the firm isn't.
Each one of there are three partners in the firm and four wealth managers, and each one of us has a little bit of a special kind of niche, if you will. Mm-hmm. My own niche happens to be physicians, and I work with quite a few physicians, most of them in private practice. Really happened organically. That guy whose last name is Andrews happens to be a physician. So right. When I started doing
just
this,
a coincidence.
Just a coincidence. So when I started doing this 30 years ago, I knew physicians. Mm-hmm. I started talking to them, and physicians will tend to refer you to other physicians.
Right.
And so that just kind of grew organically. It's a group that has sort of a special kind of collection of challenges, if you will. When I first started doing this, the challenge was really around a shortened work cycle because of their extended training. So a reduced amount of time that they had to earn money and build a portfolio.
To pay back all the debt they have.
And they usually start with a lot of debt. Right. You know, honestly, with new physicians, we don't even bother doing a balance sheet because their net worth is going to be negative.
Right. You already know going in.
There's no point showing it. It's just depressing. So that's always been there, and that continues to be the case. But now there are additional issues that physicians face. Like I said, most of the physicians I work with are in private practice, so they're actually small business owners. They've got very compressed revenue streams because there's a lot of pressure on reimbursements at this point from Medicare, Medicaid, but also health insurance companies. A lot of increased regulations that they're dealing with, which are increasing their costs. Everything from, you know, the super bill that you get when you leave your physician's office, that's actually mandated by the government, what's on there, and how they code that will dictate how they're reimbursed. So they all have a lot of increased costs and reduced revenue streams. So they're under a lot of financial pressure as well. And that's why you see a lot of private practices merging it with hospitals now. It's just a way for them to kind of get out from underneath all that regulatory and profit margin compression burden.
Now, when you do focus in on one kind of niche, like you mentioned, you kind of start learning best practices, the do's and don'ts of that. So is there any kind of, I don't want to say business consulting, but there is some like, hey, you know, you might want to consider using this type of thing. And I got a guy over here that's really, when he made this change, this helped this, or she was able to kind of save a lot of time because she moved to this technology.
We do have the advantage that we work with a number of different practices, so we can see what worked and what doesn't work. I've had practices that have sold out to publicly traded companies. How did that work? I've had practices that have merged in with hospitals. How did that work?
Right.
I've had practices that have unraveled all those things. How did that work? And we also have a group of other advisors, medical consultants who actually will work with the medical practice on various issues, even down to hiring, that kind of thing. Should they open another office? We work with CPAs and attorneys who work with a lot of medical practices. There's kind of a group of us that are sort of like a team that we know work with a lot of physicians and have experience in that area.
So that's one of the benefits of working. If you're a physician and you're choosing a financial advisor, this is one of the advantages of working with you, is because you're coming to the table not just with that. That's kind of table stakes, right? It's all this ancillary information and insight.
Exactly. All the other insight that I've developed over the last 30 years of watching the industry develop and watching the challenges there. And, you know, it helps that it impacts my own personal bottom line, too. I mean, my husband's a physician.
Right.
I understand exactly the student loans, and I get the price compression. I understand all of that.
Now, what about the exit? Like, how do physicians typically exit?
You know, that really varies by practice. Typically, you know, most practices are going to have a buy-sell agreement like any other professional firm would. They will typically have some sort of a buyout that usually happens over a number of years. It tends to not be a real significant item. Many of them, it's just, it looks more like their receivables that they're leaving behind. A few of them will price in some other things, but there's really not thought to be a lot of goodwill in medical practices typically. So most of my physicians will end up leaving, but the buyout is going to be a fairly small part of their financial plan in retirement.
So, but is that part of what you're helping them understand and to plan for?
We do help them understand. So, for instance, when we do retirement projections, we'll put that in there. We have to understand how that's going to be taxed. We have to understand how likely that is to happen, what that amount might be. So it's something that we do factor in. But I have a number of physicians who say, you know what, don't put in anything for that because I'm not sure that's going to happen. And right. And we can do that too.
So now, when you say physicians, that's medical physicians, not like dentists.
We do work with some dentists, but I tend to have a preponderance of medical of MDs.
But dentists would have a different strategy and different, there similarities? Or
it's actually fairly similar. They, you know, a lot of them in private practice, they have mm-hmm. a lot of the same kinds of issues. The insurance reimbursements are a little bit different. The buyouts tend to be a little bit different, but it's fairly similar.
What about like plastic surgeons, like things that are not typically covered by insurance? Is that different?
That is different. That is different because if you're a plastic surgeon and you can take credit cards, for instance, and you're not accepting reimbursements. Actually, my husband has said before, gosh, I should have gone into plastic surgery because all of this, you know, they still have the regulatory environment, but they don't have the pricing is a little bit different.
So, but you work with those as well?
I do have some physicians in that area. Yeah. But I will say as a general rule, regardless of the specialty that the physician is in, I really can't think of a single physician that I work with that has not had declining income over the last 5 to 8 years.
Really?
As a group, declining in actual dollars. So mm-hmm. that's just kind of the nature of the because of their increased expenses and because of the regulations. That's just kind of the nature of where the
has that impacted
is.
New people choosing to get into medicine?
I think it has. You know, when you look at the length of time it takes to get into medicine, you're going to be at least 30 before you start practicing. Many of the new physicians are more in their mid-30s, depending on what kind of a specialty. If it's a surgical specialty, it's pretty lengthy. And then they're going to have a lot of debt. $300,000-$500,000 is not uncommon. So to get past all of that and not even start working until you're 35, you need to really be in a position where this is what I love to do. This is what I want to do. This is how I want to help people. I think I'm going to make a lot of money being a physician because the future is very uncertain.
And the window of time is short.
So if I start when I'm 35 and I want to retire when I'm 60, I mean, that's a much shorter window than somebody who graduates from college when they're 22.
So that's interesting, the unintended consequences.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
So now for you, how do you see the next, now you made this change, so how do you see the next few years in your firm?
So we're really excited about this change because it opens up a lot of opportunities to us. It really allows us to, as I mentioned earlier, to offer some things to clients, not just the trading platform, but really customize what we're offering to our clients that we haven't been able to do before. It also allows us a lot of opportunities for growth. So previously we've been growing organically. You know, there are three partners in the firm, as I mentioned, and we bring on new clients. But this also allows us the opportunity to, for instance, find other like-minded advisors and merge our practices together. And mm-hmm. it affords us that opportunity. It's much easier to do that in the independent space. And so when you merge additional advisors together, you'll have additional areas of expertise that just allow us to serve an even broader group of clients.
But you still want to focus in on, like, is that a good strategy for an up-and-coming financial advisor, is to kind of have a niche that you serve and then just kind of being the go-to person in that specialty?
You know, it's interesting because when I started doing this, candidly, I kind of resisted that because I thought, well, I don't want to say I do this because then I won't work with other clients. As it turns out, I think developing an area of expertise really allows you to grow your practice much more quickly, also allows you to offer a much higher level of value to the clients that you're working with. Now, I work with a lot of different clients.
It's not exclusively physicians, but by having a specialty, do have a depth of knowledge there that most people don't have.
That most people don't have. That's exactly right. And so one of my partners, for instance, has a specialty with divorced women. There are a lot of things from a tax standpoint and things like that. She actually has a special certification there. That brings a lot of expertise to the table. Another one of my partners is a CPA. Now, he doesn't do tax returns at this point, but he has obviously a keen understanding of accounting. So he works with a lot of business owners. So it really helps us as a firm target the clients and help them move to whatever advisor is going to best suit their needs and really deliver what that client needs.
Now, can you share a story of maybe you work with somebody that started out that didn't have a lot of resources and now over the course of their career, you help them build this richer life's journey?
I can, actually.
Obviously don't name their name. Unless it's Arnold. Names. Is it Arnold?
Nellie played a doctor on TV.
We won't name names. But I have a couple of really interesting stories. One is a couple that I've worked with for probably 10 or 12 years, and their dream was to retire and buy an RV and sell their house and travel all over the country. And, you know, I've heard a lot of stories over the years about the ideas that people want to do, and a lot of times those things change. But these folks were very, very single-minded, very purposeful. We did a lot of talking about you probably want to take a few trips in that RV. And make sure that
you practice. You really like it.
See, do you really want to be in this environment with your spouse for an extended period of time?
But on TV, it looked a lot of fun.
It looked like a lot of fun, exactly. But they retired about 2 years ago. The initial plan was to do this for a year. They are still traveling around in their RV. I think that their objective now is to visit every national park. When they come through town, they'll stop and we'll meet. So that's a really fun story that, you know, it's something that we worked on for that 10-year period of time. I have another client who is interested in taking a sabbatical. She it works for herself, so she wants to take a sabbatical. Her husband's already retired, and they want to live in Europe for a couple of years. And so the idea there is, how can we make sure that that happens? How can we make sure that even if you decide you want to stay in Europe, or when you come back, you don't want to go back to work, that that's still okay, and you can go over there and enjoy yourselves and not worry about what's going to happen 2 years later. So that's something that we are working on, and I think it probably will happen in the next year or two.
Now, is there a magic number that people should shoot for when it comes to retiring?
That is a good question, and it's one we get asked a lot, actually. And really, the number depends, and it depends on when you want to retire and what you want to do when you retire. So if you want to spend $5,000 a month when you retire and you don't want to retire until you're 70, it's one thing. If you want to spend $40,000 a month when you retire and you want to retire when you're 55, there's a different number. You know, Fidelity talks about their numbers, and that what we're trying to do is help each person identify where they need to be. And, you know, there's really, if it looks like it's going to be difficult to do, there's a bunch of different levers we can pull. You can work a couple of years longer. You can spend a little bit less. You can save a little bit more. We work with clients until we come up with a plan that they're comfortable with. And then that's what we move towards. So that's why it's important for them to be able to go to our portal and say, hey, am I still on track? Am I still where I need to be so that I can retire when I'm 58 and buy that boat or whatever it is I said I wanted to do.
Now, are you finding that more people have kind of resigned themselves to, I got to work longer, at least part-time. I can't just turn this money faucet off at this age?
With our clients, usually what happens is it's not because they have to, it's because they want to. So for most of our clients, they've been very successful in their careers. They love what they do. That's why they're in the financial situation that they are. So we might plan to have them retire at 60, but here we are 62, 65, they're still working. Because they want to.
Because so, every day you got to do something. Isn't that a myth that, like, oh, I'm going to stop working, I'm going to be at the beach? I mean, that gets boring after a while, right?
Exactly. And so what we spend a lot of time doing is talking to you about, okay, if you want to retire when you're 60, you're still relatively young. So what do you want to do?
Right, join a nonprofit or do something for your legacy, right?
And to my earlier point, and try that out maybe before you jump off the bridge. Try that nonprofit and see if you enjoy it. Try traveling like you said you want to do and see if you enjoy it. Try those things. You know, before you commit and buy a house in Maine because you thought that'd always be cool, rent one for a month or two and see what you think. Because I've seen people do stuff like that.
Right, that they go all in, spend all their money, and then they're like, I hate it here.
And then they're calling
boring,
me six months later saying, I don't know what I'm doing up here. Okay, yeah, that's happened. Yeah.
Well, if somebody wanted to learn more and have more substantive conversation, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Well, best way to get a hold of us is to go out to our website, which is atlantafinancial.com.
Good URL there. That probably paid off for you.
It is
$12 a year well spent.
It is. We thought of that early on, and it was a good spend. So go to our website. There's a lot of information about our firm, a lot of information about the advisors at our firm, and you can just click on a button, and we'll give you a buzz back and see what your questions are.
Well, Julianne, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.